The Guardian.
During April, The Guardian's podcasts are partnering with audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/audible to find out more.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's podcast, we're looking at the future of photography, how much the social graph is actually worth, and whether Facebook's astounding acquisition of the 551-day-old Instagram photo app for a cool $1 billion means that we are in the midst of a new technology bubble. Well, also on the podcast, we look at the latest in the patent acquisition rush. Patent or patent? I never know which one to say, so I'm going to say patent. This time a whopper of a haul by Microsoft from AOL. And also what Larry Page has to say to his shareholders a year after being in the CEO job. Join us for Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me in the studio today are Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor, and Dan Catt, who is a Guardian software engineer and a former Flickr engineer as well, developer. Okay. So we're keeping it in the photographic family this week. Welcome to you both. Now, obviously, the big news this week that we will be discussing later in the podcast is that Instagram was bought by Facebook for $1 billion. And you have to say it. You have to say it in that voice. Now, you're both active users of the service. Why, Dan, first, why do you think it's so popular? You wrote a fantastic blog post recently about your relationship between how you were using Flickr for a long time and how you moved over to Instagram.
Yeah, a bit of a weird one, that, considering I wrote Flickr. It was all of just the ease of use. It was in the way you're sort of telling stories. So at Flickr, you'd upload photos and you'd share them with other people, and it's how you kept in sort of contact with each other. But then as everyone moved to mobile phones, there was no really good native uploader, and Instagram was just so easy in the name and the way it's just targeted around. You point it, you take a photo, it's instantly shared. And then the options to be able to push it to like Facebook and Tumblr and Twitter and Flickr just meant that you can sort of target who you want to aim that particular photo at. It's just starting conversations. It was just a lovely, streamlined, easy, fun, enjoyable, pleasant experience.
And not really intended, Charles, to be anywhere other than a mobile phone, whereas something like Flickr or Facebook, to an extent, are systems that, you know, that's where photos have to be good.
It's a bit like the sort of formal thinking of, you know, this is a photograph, you process it on a computer. I mean, it's a bit like the arguments that I've heard from people when I've said, you know, smartphones are overtaking PCs, smartphones are selling PCs, smartphones are going to become a primary computing platform. And people say, you can't do Photoshop on a smartphone. And actually sort of you can. You've got sort of iPhoto. Okay, it's not Photoshop, but, you know, you can stick a lot of filters on. Hey, I just Photoshopped it.
Good enough for government work, isn't it?
Well, it's sort of, you know, good enough for an approximation. And certainly Flickr didn't quite get the mobile thing working in the same way. I mean, back in 2006, I was trying out a phone which had auto-upload to Flickr, and that just never quite gelled because data services were too expensive then as much as anything. Flickr sort of got behind the wave. You know, the wave really moved on, and it didn't quite get there.
Well, I would say that it is still ticking over, and the fact that that it has updated some of its sharing so that you can push to various networks. It's still there, but it is, Dan, much more of a formal experience. And I think your comments on the blog post that you wrote were about Christmas and about that you could literally just point and click and it was there, it was gone.
Yeah, that's the magical turning moment. All the previous years it had been taking photos and then after the event uploading them and then seeing everyone else's Christmases as well. And you go, that's really quite nice. In the evening or the next day, you go, they had a lovely Christmas, all the families there. And then I was sitting on the sofa with Instagram and I was just taking a quick snapshot of the presents. And then other people had their Christmas photos on as well. And it was that experiencing their Christmas morning at the same time.
A shared experience. That's exactly. Interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
It was that bit that, although I was still going, I'm uploading the Christmas photos for the family, so the family will see them, and because that's where I keep my photos and I've used my proper camera for it. At the same time, I'm getting a nicer experience with just this mobile phone. Stupid small photos, you know, with filters on or not filters on or whatever. It's just like, oh, Chris has just uploaded his photo of Christmas. And you
know, this is my ham, that yeah, kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, exactly. I mean, that all went on in the morning. The shared jokes. I mean, it's very quick to evolve and switch from one thing to another.
And Charles, I suppose moblogging is something that people were talking about, I guess it must have been 8 or 9 years ago, which was very much the photography on the phone. But it never really took off in quite the mainstream way, did it? And now that we've got smartphones, things like Instagram, and to an extent other systems like Hipstamatic, which are now trying to come back, to push outwards, has really brought this idea of moblogging forward, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, people's Twitter streams become a sort of moblogging format because you can, you know, post to Instagram there or your Facebook. I mean, you know, the distinction between, oh, I'm mobile, oh, no, I'm on the desktop, just doesn't really enter into it anymore.
In October 2010, two Stanford graduates decided to combine three trends that were starting to bubble over at the technology startup scene. First, moblogging, which we talked about earlier, finally taking off thanks to the increase in good cameras on smartphones. Social networking, obviously, thank you very much to Facebook. And a hipster analog aesthetic that made perfectly good digital prints look like retro photos. That company, Instagram, has clocked up over 30 million users in less than 2 years, primarily on the Apple iPhone because they just recently launched its Android app. And as we said at the outset, it was purchased by Facebook this week for an incredible $1 billion. Now, last year at South by Southwest, I spoke with Mikey Krieger, or Mike Krieger, as I'm sure he is now worth. He is the co-founder of Instagram, and I asked him about the service, and this is what he had to say 6 months in.
I think we were just really lucky, and we just had fantastic timing when people were ready to just not just be taking photos, but be taking photos that looked beautiful, so we add filters to your photos when you take them, and also not get them stuck on your phone, but also share them with the whole world the second you take them. When we set out to define what our network was going to be, we looked at Facebook and we looked at Twitter, and what excited my co-founder Kevin and I was the idea of a world experience through photographs, no matter where you are or who you are. So instead of having a very closed off friend-based relationship, we said, bring your friends in, but if you want to connect with people halfway across the world through photographs, which are absolutely universal, require no language, you know, commonality, then there you go. Like, you've seen a photo from Japan, and now you're communicating with that person in this non-verbal way. So when we looked at both of those networks, we saw Twitter has this beautiful open graph, and we decided to say, hey, let's try to make a network that was more like that. That you could follow anybody could follow you, and see where that went. And I think it worked out really well for us. The thing I love also about people looking at the world through photos is that all of a sudden it's not just your moment, it's the moment as seen through your friend's perspective. So, hey, I took this photo of this hotel lobby, but all of a sudden somebody has an interesting comment who's been there last week, or, oh, notice that strange thing in the corner that you didn't even see in your photograph, but somebody might have seen. So the comments and the reactions that you get on Instagram to your photos after you've posted them is really, I think, what closes that loop and keeps people coming back. I think the beauty of Instagram is finding art in everyday moments, and I think the way you find that is by having a way to capture those everyday moments, and that way is probably not going to be a digital SLR for most people, which they're bulky. I have mine, I never take one out of my house because, you know, you're going to carry that around, you're going to, you know, maybe need an extra bag for it, versus a camera is always with you. So finding art in everyday moments comes from being able to capture it and learning and sort of getting into the habit of wanting to capture those things. So I think we've started a pattern, I hope to keep building on it, you know, in the years to come, of elevating our everyday lives into little works of art that sort of get sent out into the world.
Mike Krieger from Instagram at South by Southwest 2011. Joining us down the line is Stuart Dredge, who runs the Guardian's apps blog. Stuart, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast this week. Tell me a little bit about what it is that Facebook is getting.
Well, like you said, it's getting a network of 30 million plus users. So it's under, I think it's under a million in a day after they went on Android, so quite possibly a few more since then. So it's getting people, it's getting the development talent behind the team, so it's getting all 13 people, which is probably the smallest team to be sold for $1 billion, as far as I'm aware. But the announcement made it very clear that it's not just about the team. So I think Facebook got this record of buying startups and then shutting down whatever they were doing just because they want developers, whereas here they're saying very much they want to keep it going, they want to build on it and make it stronger, which is one of the first worries, I think, a lot of its passionate users had last night, that it would basically be shut down.
Is this a neutralization strategy? Because Facebook does obviously have its own photo sharing service, i.e. Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, in a way, it's plugging one of its holes. It didn't have really good photo editing features. So kind of in a way, they've plugged that hole. But yeah, I mean, Instagram was growing so fast, and obviously it's nowhere near on the scale of Facebook, which is, what, 850 million people now, I think, every month. But it kind of had that potential to kind of strike at its photo feature, which is kind of one of the key reasons I think people use Facebook a lot. So I think it has been had its eye on who's coming up and who could possibly be a competition in the future. Well, I guess more importantly, who could make one of its proper competitors, like a Google or an Apple or a Twitter even, if it was bought by one of them. So in a way, it's a defensive acquisition, possibly, from that point of view.
And you mentioned, actually, that they're getting the social network. One thing that I find particularly interesting about this is that, and Charles, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, the Facebook network is a reciprocal network. I have to ask you, Charles. I have to ask you, Stuart. I have to ask you, Dan. Will you be my friend? And if you say yes, then we're connected. And that's what Facebook has as its default. Yet Instagram doesn't have that. Instagram has a much looser network. How do you think, Charles, that's, you know, going to impact on Facebook's use of, you know, advertising, their business model?
I think that for Facebook, it doesn't matter that it's not a reciprocal system on Instagram, because they get the benefit of people being on it. And to some extent, yes, I agree with what Stuart said, that it's a defensive move. One of the things, for example, that Google Plus has, which people do like about it, from what I've heard, is they like the sort of automatic upload from Android phones to Google Plus. And it's become very popular with people who are photographers, so you can see a lot of photos on it. And I think that getting Instagram was a good way for Facebook to pull in that sort of, you know, people rather like Dan was describing earlier, where, you know, you take a photo, you want to share it, and bang, there it is. And that's something which enhances Facebook. It keeps people on Facebook or associated with a Facebook network rather than, say, a Google network. And that's an obvious benefit for Facebook, and it's an obvious disadvantage, if you like, for Google in trying to catch up.
Well, the function, Stuart, of an acquisition is to make money, obviously, for them, with the technology and with the network, et cetera. So how is Facebook, now the parent company of this separate network, how will Facebook use the Instagram data you know, that people like us are giving to it to make money from our data?
It's a big question, really, because, I mean, it's quite possible Instagram's made nothing so far from at all in revenues from anyway. I mean, it hadn't got to that point yet where it was saying we're going to start turning on our monetization, or whatever the horrible phrase is. I don't know, I think Charles said it right. It's basically about people spending time on Facebook, and time is money for them. So photos don't really make direct revenues for Facebook already, but they keep you on there, keep you coming back, and they keep you using it. So it's partly that, I guess. I mean, there is some stuff happening with brands and Instagram. I mean, they hadn't got to the point of charging them yet. Much like Facebook isn't charging brands to do a lot of stuff on the main social network. So there's probably some scope there, but I think it's more about making the Facebook sort of system a bit more sticky, keeping people coming back, and yeah, kind of defending itself against people running off to Google Plus or whatever Apple comes up with in the next few years, because they've got better, more engaging photo features.
I got a question that I hope someone can answer. When I was reading up about it, last week the rumours were, or they just closed $50 million worth of funding.
Yes, $50 million, which valued them at $500 million, yes.
Which is half of the billion, is that right? Getting wrong. So I think, is that part of the threat to Facebook? Did like Facebook blink? Because Instagram wasn't really a threat before. But with no revenue stream, but you suddenly put $50 million into Instagram, is that then going to turn it into something that then is a threat to Facebook? So Facebook went, we have to buy it now.
I don't think it's a threat directly to Facebook. It's not as if Instagram was suddenly going to morph into a beast which was also offering logins for music services and was going to be overtaking your social graph where you'd spend all your time on Instagram. But the thing is that it could become something which would be even more attractive for people to spend time on. It might start to attract its own advertising, and there's only a limited amount of that to go around. And you know, you can see that would all work towards the sort of view that it's subtracting. You know, there's only so much attention people can have. It's subtracting from the attention people have in one place. So if Facebook's aim in life is basically to wrap you in its giant blanket and have you on it all the time, even if you don't actually intend to be, then acquiring Instagram becomes the logical thing to do.
But at the same time, The deal is that the two will still be separate. And Stu and Charles, you have both said that this is about stickiness for Facebook. But I can still quite happily ignore Facebook and still use Instagram. And so therefore, I'm not even anywhere near Facebook if I'm using Instagram.
Now, I'm fascinated to see what happens now, because really, I really want the reports. It gets the impression that was pretty much the key price. It was less about money and more about independence. And like this chap, Kevin Systrom, the CEO, he's got, I think it's $400 million, one report said, that he's worth. He had a 40% stake in the company. And if he either goes on now within Facebook and makes Instagram a huge success and carries on, or he goes off and does something else at some point, which is often what entrepreneurial types do. And I think that's going to be the key crunch point, really. Not less what they're saying now, but more give it a year or two if he's still there and the team's still there. And if they're not, does it then just get folded back into Facebook?
But look at other things that the Facebook will get from a photo that you take. It can get things like location data, time of day data. It can get, you know, who you are, who you've shared it with. It can get all that social graph data, and the things like location and time, which even if you're not sort of looking to be monetized by, Facebook can use that.
Can it get device data? How deeply does it go?
All the EXIF data that's available. It'll mine it as hard as it can. That's one of the things that they're really good at.
I mean, do you remember when Flickr used to be the kind of the gold bar? People would write stories about how the iPhone was now the most popular camera on Flickr, and that was a standard by which people knew what was being used. Hmm. And nowadays, you just say it's things like Instagram and Facebook mobile apps.
Yes, it would be interesting to see what the numbers are for Instagram, actually. And the other thing is, I mean, one of the things we're wondering about is, you know, is a comparison perhaps to Google acquiring YouTube back in 2006, which was $1.6 billion for a company, again, which had zero revenue. And that was an audacious move, but one that seems to have been, you know, proven to be a pretty smart one. The interesting difference, I think, is between the liability. So, for example, people taking pictures with Instagram, there's pretty much no liability. You know, Facebook is not going to get sued by people because, you know, you stole my photo. That's just not really going to happen to any large extent. But it's interesting to contrast YouTube, where people spend a lot of time, obviously, much longer than they do with a photo. But it opens Google up to lawsuits all the time from people like Viacom. There's one which has just been reopened.
Yeah.
Well, what if people start taking photographs of copyrighted material and putting them on? I don't know why they would do that, but what if?
Well, yeah, photograph of copyrighted material is actually still, it's a new piece of material.
Well, that's a Pinterest problem, though, isn't it? Because there it really is copyrighted material.
And yes.
I've talked to people recently who've said that Pinterest has more of a problem with potential acquirers there. And which is why one of its terms and conditions are quite controversial, aren't they? Because they, essentially, it's all on you if you get sued.
What has been really interesting about the response, particularly on Twitter, it seems that that's where most people have gone to voice their concerns, Dan, is that people are just not very happy about this. And why is that, do you think?
That's the people on Twitter who are just not very happy. But
pesky, miserable people on Twitter.
That just
tends to
be the direction. All the other people will just carry on using it and they'll just all be fine and happy. I thought the most entertaining or interesting reaction was about the guy who posted the text message from his daughter, where she was like, oh, no, Facebook are going to ruin it. And he's like, why are they going to ruin it? It's, oh, Facebook's for old people.
Ah!
Yeah, it's for old and stupid people. And I thought that was quite an interesting insight that...
People are very passionate about it. But in the same way, it's one of those... I saw a tweet just now of someone saying, you know, this thing you've been using for free and never been asked to pay for is now, you know, bought by someone else.
Spoiled irrevocably.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing as well, I mean, Google bought Dodgeball and then did nothing with it. And then the founders left again and made Foursquare, which was exactly the same thing and went off. So recent interviews with Kevin, he was very much talking about Instagram as a platform and how he's going to extend it out and then build more on it and clearly had plans for it. And then with the funding coming in, you wouldn't get funding if you knew that Facebook was going to buy you. So it seems like they had all these distant plans. So because things move quite quickly, I'm wondering what they have in place to stop someone like Kevin or someone else just going, here's an Instagram alternative, and then just people just jumping across to that one and then Facebook ending up with this thing that no one uses. It could shift in the space of like 12 months, 18 months to us not caring about Instagram and using the next new thing that's slightly better. I would jump to a new photo thing if my friends, a couple of friends are there. It would take me 2 months maybe to move over.
The separateness issue, and you've just kind of alluded to it there. What is interesting about this is that, you know, Facebook is for a particular group of my friends, right? And Twitter is for a different kind of network that I have. And I very much use Instagram as something completely different. And there is some overlap, but I don't necessarily always shove things out to Twitter or shove things out to Facebook. I like to keep that separate. And so now Facebook has the information from that separate network. And I mean, this. Do you see, Dan, a drive towards separateness or a movement within the internet towards separateness in the future? Or will everything be acquired by Facebook and Google?
I think everything will continuously be acquired and then people just move on to something else. I think there is that separateness. I agree. Sort of, I use Facebook in one way, Instagram in another way, and now they're joined together. I'm like, I really liked Instagram, but I would just quite happily move to something else. So I think people do compartmentalize, particularly the younger. When you get into teenagers, they're really smart about when they switch things on or switch things off, and they're quite happy to move.
So, Stuart, one final question: $1 billion is a lot of money, and Charles, you've looked at a past example with Google and YouTube, but surely this indicates that we're in a little bit of a bubble, doesn't it, Stuart?
I guess. I mean, I suppose any company is worth what someone wants to pay for it. I mean, if it stops Facebook becoming the next Friendster, then $1 billion is cheap, I guess. I mean, you can bet that all the other photo sharing apps are going to be sitting there going, sort of half gnashing their teeth and half saying, right, our valuation just climbed. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know. In this case, I think there's a lot of good things for Facebook in doing it. And actually, there are a lot of sensible reasons why to buy it and why to pay this much. But yeah, I mean, in terms of a bubble, it doesn't feel like people are delivering pet food like in the first Web 1.0 boom just yet. I mean, the things that have come out have flopped pretty quickly in the apps world. So my hope is it's not a bubble, but it's going to give fuel to people who think it is, I suppose.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Stuart Dredge, for joining us down the line. The Nokia Lumia 900 launched this week in the US, and I know that at the center of its marketing strategy here in the UK is its camera. As an aside, Dan, I'm curious, why is a camera on a phone so darn important? I mean, it seems to have revolutionized very much how we consume and produce media.
Because it's always with you. That's right, it's always in your pocket. We saw this at Flickr when Flickr was built for people to share photos. So you had this thing like proper professional photographers kind of took to it to promote their photos, but it was really all about families just taking photos of their cats and kids. That was the majority use case, but you still needed a point and shoot camera. So the adoption was quite low, and we thought, oh, these things will get cheaper. These, more people have a point and shoot. And then as soon as the mobile phones, it's the Nokia really started driving it with cameras, it just exploded. And we're like, it's not like we didn't expect this, but we were surprised by exactly how fast the uptake of mobile cameras were and how that really ate into the SLR market. And interestingly, there are lots of people worried about, oh, this is going to kill cameras. But it actually turned more people interested in photography because you buy a phone, because I need a phone, but it has a camera on it. Then you start using it. Then you use it more. Then you suddenly get far more interested in photography. So for photography, a camera phone is really great. And there's people who might not have ever bought a camera, like a point-and-shoot, who might, and loads of people who never will, because they'll just keep using the one on the device, and they just get better and better. The lenses are really good. The software on it, which you don't get on a camera that you buy a point-and-shoot, but you do have it on the actual mobile device. They're just great devices for taking photos.
You mentioned the lens, actually. There's a Zeiss lens on the Lumia 900, which is very nice.
Well, it says it's very nice. And yet, I mean, I've used a Lumia 800. Yeah. And when I've compared it against the iPhone 4S, I've found that the pictures taken with the 4S are better. And I was, even actually when I went to Nokia back in January and I was taking pictures of their head of design, I took it with an iPhone because I knew the pictures would come out better because I had done side-by-side comparisons of the two. Yeah. And some of the reviews of the 900 from the US have said, actually, these photos are not so good. And it's quite interesting. I think I'd like to map out the trajectory of how it is that the iPhone went from, in its first model, having a really crappy camera. Everyone said, 2 megapixels, that thing's rubbish. You know, it's 5 megapixels now. This is back in 2007. Now people say, iPhone 4S, damn good camera. Yeah. When did that happen? When did it overtake the rest of the field?
Yeah, I went to have a look at the lots of the Nokia photos, and they were quite noisy. When I was, you go into the original, there's lots of noise and dots, pixels all over the shop.
For my money, I still think, and you know, I don't have one of these, but I have seen the Samsung cameras on their phones are very nice. They really pick up the blues, I think, and that's always a problem with photography. So, Charles, it's not just the camera, obviously, that's in the device. What else is going on in there?
Well, obviously, the key thing about it being a Lumia model from Nokia is that it runs Microsoft's Windows Phone software. In the hardware side, it's got LTE, long-term evolution, so it's the US version of 4G. So it's super high-speed internet if you're in the right place to get it. And you know, there are places in the US which do it. And it's got a larger battery than the 800 so that it'll be able to do this sort of thing. So it'd be interesting in the UK, actually. It might be that with the larger battery, it'll have a much longer life. But obviously, the 4G element won't work in the UK because we don't have 4G.
Unless you're on the number 52.
Unless you're on the number 52.
As we found last week.
Yes, the other day. Although, I don't know whether that'd be on the right frequency. If this is the LTE tune for the US frequencies, then it won't work in the UK, which is all the joy of non-standardization across the networks. So, yeah, it's a very promising device, doesn't have NFC, although Stephen Alup, who's the CEO at Nokia, did say back in January when they launched it at CES that he's very interested by NFC.
What is NFC?
Near-field communication, which is sort of Bluetooth-like communication. So I've seen, for example, some Nokia headphones which use NFC and are very cool because you just put them on, there's no lead, and it just uses NFC to send the signal.
Now, Nokia has made a deal with AT&T for its corporate phones. I imagine this is, you know, quite a good thing for Nokia.
Yes, Nokia, as it is. What they've got is, it's called a spiff, which is that they have an incentive for people in the shops where they sell them to get a Nokia phone for free. So they can trade in their old phones. The people who are actually in the shops will have them, will have the, you know, the Lumias. So that when people say, well, what do you use? They'll say, well, I've got a Nokia Lumia. And the hope is that this will incentivize, you know, shoppers to actually buy a Lumia themselves. It's all being paid for from Microsoft's marketing budget, as we understand it. We're talking some tens, possibly hundreds of millions here. And it'll remain to be seen how effective it is. Some people were critical of the idea of launching the Lumia 900 during the Easter weekend, when perhaps the shops wouldn't be as open as they might otherwise be. But it's early days. You know, I think it's all very hard. But again, the reviews have said we've seen enough Windows Phone devices now. We can't sort of say, oh yes, Microsoft, it's such an interesting new operating system, because it's not new now. It's 2 years old. It's really time for Microsoft and Nokia to, you know, stand up and actually show how well they can do against Android and the iPhone.
So with everything that we've got going for it, we've got a camera, which is, you know, isn't fabulous, but it's, you know, whatever. And all of the other bells and whistles that are on the device, and this relationship with AT&T. Will the Nokia Lumia 900 swim, or will it sink? And if it sinks, what does this mean for the burning platform?
good mixed metaphors.
Thank you.
Will it sink or swim? I think it will sort of bob around the surface. I think it's going to be difficult to persuade. Even though they're doing a big discount whereby they're offering it to people for, it's either $100 or it's for free, but that's on a very expensive contract per month. So I'm not sure that it's really going to attract people over, say, a Nexus device or even an HTC or a Motorola. You know, there's lots of competition out there. And of course, the iPhone is still being sold out there. You can get an old 3GS, or you can get a 4, or you can get a 4S. There's a lot of competition. And the question is it good enough? Does it look enough like other phones, or is the Windows Phone interface just too radical? Yeah, I think there are people for whom the Windows Phone interface is just right. People with comparatively small networks who are on Facebook a lot. But again, the built-in Facebook app or the built-in Twitter app isn't up to the quality of the standalone apps. And given that, why would you use the built-in operating system? So I don't know. I find it really hard to know whether it's going to break through, and even the incentive of AT&T, I'm not sure is going to be enough this time round.
When will it be released in the UK? Do we have dates?
The Phones for You is going to be offering it starting quite soon. So if you want to run down and get a Lumia 900 from Phones for You, then they're going to be the ones with it.
Okay. And in the ongoing patent race, it's been announced that Microsoft has bought more than 800 patents from AOL for $1.1 billion. Charles, which patents have they purchased?
They relate to an enormous range of things, including SSL and Java, some elements relating to JavaScript. The suggestion seems to be it's to do with Microsoft wanting to have some sort of influence on HTML5. But quite what Microsoft wants out of it is a bit up in the air at the moment. It's it might be to do with Android, having more weapons to fire against Android, or it might be simply that it wants to extend its patent portfolio. It's almost becoming one of the biggest patent owners out there.
Is anybody making anything anymore, or are they just buying stuff from other people and then throwing it out one another?
There's a hell of a trade in patents, I'll tell you that.
We report on it almost every week, which is absolutely fascinating in the battleground. But why the sale? What is AOL doing? are they just getting rid of their dead wood, or are they saying, help, help, give us some cash?
Well, they are trying to raise money. That's really the long and short of it. What keeps AOL afloat is, surprisingly, it's not Arianna Huffington's millions. What it is subscribers in the US who haven't realized that they can get a broadband deal and who are still paying sort of $15 a month, every single month, for a dial-up subscription, even though they can get broadband and stuff like that. And there are millions of people out there who are doing this. And that is what is keeping AOL afloat. But they're gradually getting told by their younger relatives, or they're dying. And basically, it really is literally like this, that their income stream is dying off. The patents thing, which is going to be paid back in dividends to shareholders, well, that's nice for the shareholders, but that's not an income stream in the future, is it?
So there is this move basically to keep the shareholders sweet.
Yeah.
So is this a good move on Microsoft's part?
Oh, yeah. Having more patents is always good for them.
And finally this week, Larry Page, the CEO of Google, has written an open letter to the search giant's shareholders, reviewing his first year in the position and outlining his intentions for the next 12 months. Charles, what did it say?
It took a lot of words to say, hey, everything is really great and fantastic and wonderful.
Don't we love our Google Plus, blah, blah, blah. Social networking is where it's at.
But in terms of really hard information, not a great deal. He sort of explained why they've killed off some of the products. So he said, people shouldn't have to navigate Google to get stuff done. It should just happen. As Sergey Brin, co-founder, said in the memorable way only he can, we've let 1,000 flowers bloom. Now we want to put together a coherent bouquet.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is nice.
Flowery language.
Doesn't actually sort of quite mean a great deal. There's a few interesting stats in there. Well over 100 million users are active on Google Plus, which is their social network, launched in sort of the middle of last year. Doesn't say how often they're active, nor how long they're active for. He talks about the number of Gmail users, which is in the 350 million mark. He talks about the number of Android devices being activated, more than 850,000 daily. But there's not a great deal where you'd say, oh, okay, I really understand where you're going now.
There's also, out the back of this, there's been some response about the fact that it seems that Wikipedia, that Apple, that Microsoft are moving away from Google Maps. And
Microsoft has never been there, but yes.
Well, of course not. They have their own system. But, the Maps thing, which is one of the most consistent and shining stars in the Google pantheon, as it were.
Yeah, it's interesting because he does say in here, he says about Maps, he says Maps is, where's the phrase, it's something like our most loved service that's used by 77% of people or something online. But interestingly, at the same time, Wikipedia is now moving away from using Google Maps in its mobile service, and as far as I can find out, it's never used it, or certainly doesn't now use it in its desktop version. So the Android and the iOS versions of Wikipedia will now use OpenStreetMap. OpenStreetMap, founded by Steve Coast, who's a British guy, and that is an independent foundation. Microsoft provides a lot of help for it, and my understanding was that they also provided some hosting for OpenStreetMap maps. And basically what Microsoft is trying to do to Google and Google Maps is the same as Google did with Android to Microsoft and Windows Mobile. You know, basically disrupt it by being a free version. Go for the open source, anyone can get at it version. And I think it's a very interesting strategy by Microsoft.
Yeah, Dan, what are the benefits of using OpenStreetMap or any of these different systems over a Google proprietary?
I think it's the timeliness of it. The OpenStreetMaps had one of these crazy things going, we'll get people to give us all the map data, they'll walk around to GPSs. So it started off quite small and cottage industry. But then as it grew and more people became aware of it, the actual updates to the data set is happening faster than it is for Google Maps and so on and so forth. So Google Maps have their cars driving around every now and then and sort of map it. And OpenStreetMaps are just getting data from all over the shop. So all sorts of people are sharing. I think there's some nav companies that are sharing their data with them as well. And it's just updated so much faster. We could see this a couple of years ago when there's a new story or disaster around an area. OpenStreetMap had people on the streets just updating a lot faster. Emergency response as well is a really great place where OpenStreetMap just beats any other. When it's really important, then OpenStreetMap seems to be down there and they update it. So it's kind of by the people, for the people. You correct some of the information or add a street, then you know it goes into this whole big open data set that anybody else can use. It's the beauty of open.
But is OpenStreetMap really by the people, for the people in the know? You know, the people who... I imagine that one of the reasons why Google Maps is one of the best-loved services in Google is because when you stick a Google search in and you stick an address in, up pops a Google map of the system. You know, is that? I imagine that's probably why. It's not as if OpenStreetMap is also offered alongside. So, you know, yeah. OpenStreetMap is something that is a niche audience at the minute. Would this Wikipedia thing explode that?
I think so. Yeah, I think it's. I mean, people don't generally know which maps they're using. Well, I suppose that's not quite true. But as they get presented with them, OpenStreetMap is now at the quality and the render of the tiles and how it just looks and feels and works. It's really good now. So I don't think people will mind or go, oh, this is terrible. I can't believe Wikipedia is using this map. I wish they were using Google Maps and things like that. And I know Microsoft have their Bing where they concentrate a lot of effort on maps. But where the mapping came from, when Google first did maps, they didn't envisage it being used by lots of developers and on other websites. That all came from people going, oh, there's a new way of doing maps that wasn't, here's a map and click a button to go east a bit. You could actually slide the map
God,
around.
God, I remember that.
And exactly. I can remember all the people picking apart the code, trying to work out how to then incorporate it in the site. It's only in response that Google went, oh, people want to use them. And then they responded to the developer community that this whole emergence of maps on other people's websites came about. And that's when like Steve and the other people go, we can't let Google have like the monopoly on this. This would be really bad because they're going to spread onto sites and then go, and now we're going to show you adverts. And now we're going to track where you're looking. And you know that seems like a bad thing. So we need to set up an alternative to do that. We have some streets in London and the Tiger data set. Let's see what we can do with it and build it from there.
So for developers, what is the benefit then? You've mentioned the benefit for users.
The benefit is, well, you don't have to pay for it if it gets big. So it's free. The Google Maps is free to developers under a certain kind of rate limit. But now they've started charging. So if you suddenly start using it an awful lot, then you pay for it. An OpenStreetMap, you know, you can download a whole dump of the OpenStreetMap and then render the tiles yourself, serve them however you want, pull out the data you do want or you don't want, or represent them. Or you can use a mapping service. I think there's CloudMate and a couple of other services that will render tiles for you, and you can pick your own color scheme. So it's very much about the customization. I mean,
it is the Android of maps, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You can do a lot, and you sort of, surprisingly, the
like that. That's good.
Surprisingly, the color scheme is just one of those small things, but it is kind of important when you're presenting data on top of it and the map isn't the important thing. Like if the whole idea of, I mean, the common one of presenting photos or navigating around, you don't want the map to be the primary thing. You want it just to be a framework to put other data on. And you can't really straightforward to do that with Google Maps, but you can as a developer sort of tune your map to step back or be as forefront as you like.
And Charles, is there anything about the future within Larry's Larry? I say that like I know him within Lair Bear's Larry Page's letter out to his shareholders.
Well, he just talks about the need to balance the short term and the long term. He talks about making big bets. How years ago people thought that the whole idea of going with Android and stuff was crazy. But he says, happiness is a healthy disregard for the impossible, that actually it's easier to get your head around trying to solve something that's impossible than it is to just do something incremental. So he talks about, for example, AdSense, which is, he says, paid out over $30 billion to partners, was a result of a failed, more ambitious project to understand the web. It's all interesting. There's nothing specific. There's nothing you would really pin down and say, oh, okay, he says that in 12 months we will do X. Rather, as they've said that there'll be a Google tablet. There are reports now that that was expected in May, now expected to be delayed till June. It looks really impressive, this. It's very long, and it talks about all sorts of accomplishments, and yet you don't quite get the feeling that they've of what they've done in the past year. And equally, he completely avoids issues like people got really worked up about privacy, or the fact that they're still waiting for the European Commission and the FTC in the US to rule on antitrust issues, or the fact that they got all sorts of legal imbroglios going on. So, for example, in France, Google Maps was found guilty of undercutting French mapping services by offering their things free. None of the hassles. It's a rose-tinted view of the Google world. And you've got to hope that bad news travels upwards. Because one of the things that Bill Gates always said, and Bill Gates, it has to be said, was one of the best chief executives there's ever been at any tech company ever. One of the things that was a ironclad rule at Bill Gates's Microsoft was, bad news has to travel upwards. You've got bad news, tell it upwards. Because if you don't do that, then you're not actually helping the company.
Yeah, the foundations crumble and the captain sinks along with the ship. Well, thank you very much for that. Read up on all these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. And apologies to Larry Page for calling him Lair Bear. That's it for this week's podcast. Many thanks to Charles and to Dan in the studio and Stuart down the line. Next week, we're looking at the de-anonymization of the web at the hands of systems like Facebook and Google and the people who are fighting back. We'll be speaking with Chris Poole from the image board 4chan and Andrew Luman from Tor. Links to all the stories from this week are available at guardian.co.uk/techweekly, where you can also find out how to get in touch. We're back next Tuesday. I'm Alex Kratowski. This week's producer was Jason Phipps. Thank you very much for listening.
During April, The Guardian's podcasts are partnering with audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/audible to find out more.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.